Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm in conversation with the futurist Christopher Barnett. Christopher Barnett is Associate Professor of Computing and Future Studies in Nottingham University Business School and the author of ExplainingComputers.com, ExplainingTheFuture.com and their popular YouTube channels. He has written five previous books on computing and future studies, including A Brief Guide to Cloud Computing, and lectures and consults widely on cloud computing and Web 2.0. His latest book, which we talk about in today's interview, is 25 Things You Need to Know About the Future. Chris, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Excellent. It's nice to be on the show.
So, you're a futurist, a professor of future studies. Now, I'm presuming there's not a crystal ball involved in this. So let's talk first of all about what mechanisms do we have for studying the future, something that hasn't happened yet?
There's a range of things. I mean, I suppose to give a broad premise, a futurist is someone who tries to point out a wide range of options. I always say it's not about trying to predict a single definitive future.
Sure.
It's trying to predict a range of futures that could happen with certain technologies or other changes, and then people can pick from them. So it's a bit like if you had an architect and you asked them to draw some plans of a new building, they could draw several plans, you would pick one, and you might build that, and that would be the future. But they wouldn't have predicted that so much, they were giving you the options. So I often think future gazing and future shaping go together. In terms of the tools we've got, I suppose one of the most fundamental for me is looking at the way technologies are developing. And the time frame that I tend to look at is sort of 10 to 20 years out. And that means a lot of those technologies are already being developed at their very early stages in research labs and universities right around the world. So the book I've just done looks at about 300 different places and what they're working on. And many of those things are likely to enter into commercial application over, you know, the next decade or so.
And to what extent do sort of technologies repeat themselves in their development? Right at the end of the book, you talk about the rise of the internet as a sort of parallel with things that might happen in the future.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of cycles. I mean, particularly we've seen this with communications technologies. You can go back to even sort of building the canals was a means of linking people together. We could all communicate more. People were less locally based. Then we got the railways, and then right back to the internet boom of 20 years ago. So effectively, you can see patterns of how technologies change things. And I think from that you can spot technologies that might be critical in it, if you like, changing the world. But it will depend what people do with them. And I guess for me, a lot of it is about pointing out that we could have fairly radical change. People tend to assume the world is pretty fixed. And yet you say, well, look what happened with the internet and computing in the last 20 years. And they go, oh, yes, that's changed quite a lot, didn't it? And they say, well, that could happen with medicine in the next 20 years, or that could happen with agriculture in the next 20 years. And that's when you start to get people thinking, oh, yes, and that's what, you know, future studies tries to do. It tries to help individuals and organisations look at what's happening and then address things like the ethical issues, hopefully, before we actually get there.
You mentioned a moment ago the idea of things going in cycles, and there's an interesting part of the book where you talk about the idea of the concept of the future that we had any sort of control over, I guess, is quite a new thing in human development.
Yes, very much, because I suppose if you look back to, you know, our very early ancestors, they had change in their lives, but the change was basically the change, you know, of the seasons. They knew that we were going to get cold and warm and there'd be harvest times and that type of thing. But past was, you know, lost somewhere in history, and the future was often thought of as the end of the world. And so although there was change, there was no novelty. Basically, the world would repeat in cycles, as it always had for ancient peoples. And it's only in sort of the past few hundred years we've really started to go, we could fundamentally change the world. And more than that, we actually, in some ways in our lives, expect that. We expect new mobile phones, you know, we expect new fashions, we expect to constantly upgrade our computers. And yet we do have a view that everything else must be fixed. And it's strange in a time when, you know, we've just seen them still going through things like the massive financial collapse, you know, worldwide, that was perfectly predictable. It was bound to happen at some point. And yet there was a sort of reluctance to see that. So we have this weird paradox at the moment. We expect certain technologies to rapidly advance and be constantly obsolete. And yet so many other things, we just think, well, it's gone on like that for a while. It must keep going on like that.
So
a concept that's often raised on the show is this idea that people's perception of the future goes through cycles as well, in that sometimes we're optimistic about it and sometimes we're pessimistic about it. And we can all, you know, talk about looking back to our childhoods, thinking about now how we're all going to be living on the moon and having jetpacks and stuff. And then science fiction is often full of sort of like futuristic dystopias. Is this a new thing, or is this something that people have always really thought?
I think that there's always been the two tensions. I think if you look in a lot of work at the moment, you've got a lot of people talking about the future in a very bleak way. And I start this book off by talking about things like peak oil and peak water and shortages of resources and things. So I think that we've almost got into these two categories. There's the people over that side, and then there's a bunch of people talking about exponential technological progress, people who talk about what's called the singularity, heading towards a point in time where anything becomes possible because of developments in technology. But you very rarely get these two together. And I suppose what I've tried to do is to say, well, we are going to face some fundamental challenges, and that is not something to get terribly depressed about, but life is going to be different, and technology will hopefully help us deal with that. And I think there's a sort of parallel in that in our own lives, in that as we get older, we don't have the same amount of, energy and sort of physical vitality as when we were younger. That's a natural process, if you like. And we learn to live in a different way, using more, you know, our wisdom and our knowledge rather than the ability to be physically absolutely fit as we were in our 20s. So I think, to some extent, our civilization is getting to that point of being in its 30s to 40s, you know, where we are going to have big challenges ahead that, you know, we have to deal with, particularly related to environment and resource availability. But technology will offer the opportunity to deal with that. And for me, therefore, the future is going to be different. It isn't going to be almost better or worse.
So let's have a look at some of those challenges then. You said, as you said, you start off the book looking at... The book is basically split into five sections, and we'll sort of we'll go through each as we go along. But as you said, the first one is really the most pessimistic of the book, laying out the terms as to what we can expect in the near future and the challenges that we're going to have to face. So let's talk about some of those things. What sort of things do you mean?
For me, I think the biggest one coming along is peak oil, which is the idea that we will hit the point of maximum oil production globally, and beyond that, we won't instantly run out of oil, but we will start to have oil prices going up, supply going down. And given that we built ourselves a totally petroleum-based economy worldwide, that will have, you know, major implications for transport, but also for how we produce our food, how we produce many products. We rely on plastics a lot at the moment, so we're going to have to change how we live just because of the oil situation.
You go on to talk about other peaks as well, peak food and water.
Food and water, which in some extent also link a little bit back into the oil situation. One of the things I was, you know, quite surprised to find when, you know, researching the book is how strongly our food supply is related to oil supply. In many developed nations, the figure is something like every calorie we eat uses 10 calories of oil to transport the food and to package it and the use in pesticides, etc. So, you know, oil supplies being more constrained will actually affect food supplies. We've obviously got more people on the planet every year. That will affect food supplies. Water, fresh water, is becoming more scarce, not so much in the United Kingdom, but around the world, many countries are facing falling water tables, from the United States through to China and India. That will hit food supply. And then there's just the practicality of there's only so much we can dig out of the ground. There was a study by the United Nations this year, and they reckoned that if we don't change what we're doing, we'll need about 140 billion tonnes of natural resources a year, I think it's 2030, which is about three times what we use today. You know, you don't have to be a futurist to work out that actually these resources aren't there, so we're going to have to start living slightly differently. So all those things at the start of the book just set up this context. It's not trying to doom-monger, but it's trying to say we are going to have to make some changes.
Well, I think my sort of favourite part of that, there's a sort of rather delicious irony, if I can put it like that, in that in talking about resource depletion, so many of the wonderful shiny gadgets and things that we think of as being an integral part of the future use resources, very extremely rare metals that are just finite.
Yes, it is quite extraordinary, isn't it? It's the one that most strongly stands out for me, I think, is indium, which is used in making liquid crystal display screens, which, you know, could all be gone by 2020 at the rate of current consumption. We will probably find other ways to make screens, but it is extraordinary that we are so dependent on, as you say, rare metals that power all of our electronic devices in terms of making the circuits and things. And we just assume they're going to be there forever, and it isn't guaranteed.
And of course, over the top of all of these at the same time happening is climate change. You describe all of these things at the beginning of the book, but you're clear to point out that you're not being pessimistic in this, but are seeing it as all of these things present opportunities as well as challenges. So let's perhaps talk about how some of these things can be seen as opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are opportunities to change how we live, how our value systems fit together more than anything else. I think, you know, one of the biggest changes coming along is that we've had two or three decades where globalisation has been the key. I mean, if you want to succeed, everyone's supposed to globalise and produce things all over the world. And that will change, I think, because, you know, localisation will be the new globalisation, because people will start to go, well, do we have to import our food from all over the world? You know, do we have to fly in apples to the United Kingdom, which has got quite good at making its own apples, or should be? So I think we could get a return, not to entirely local livings, but to more local production of certain items, to get more in touch with the world. I mean, if you look at, say, particularly, say, food shortages, one of the things I bring up is about vertical farming, which is the idea we could start to produce a lot more food inside our cities. And one of the ways to do that is to literally build skyscrapers, which are farms. So you've got fields stacked one on top of the other, effectively, although using hydroponics, not lots of soil, producing food where people are. And that's, I think, a good example of a sort of a new way of thinking about where resources come from. We've got used to cities being totally dependent on resources brought in from hundreds and thousands of miles away. And, you know, over 50% of people on the planet live in a city. Those cities are going to have to become more, you know, self-sufficient.
One of the challenges facing anybody that's looking at tackling any of those challenges that you've raised is the tendency of people to ignore or even deny that they're happening.
Absolutely.
And that's, in some respects, I think this is understandable because it's a comforting thing, I suppose. Mm. How do we go about sort of overcoming that mindset?
I think clearly the political system doesn't help, as you infer, that we have politicians all over the world who are voted into office for fairly short periods of time. You know, they can say, well, these things hit us in 5 years? They probably won't. To be honest, in 10, a lot of them will, but, you know, it's a couple of elections away. I think one of the issues is, first of all, trying to give people good information, and that's what we're doing now. We're having discussions, and we don't discuss this sort of thing enough. The other one is trying to present people with problems and solutions. I think if you simply say, oh, there's going to be terrible times ahead because of all these changes, then people either turn off and go, well, you know, what am I supposed to do about it? I think if you can start to say, well, these are some of the challenges we face. These are some of the technologies that could perhaps help us and new ways of living. This is how we might go about it. You start to get an interest. I mean, going back to the food one, one of the projects I came across while doing the book was called the Window Farmers Project, which is was set up by people initially in New York, where they're using hydroponics to grow food in their windows. It literally is a window farm. They reckon the average size window can produce a salad a week. And it's basically an online community of about 30,000 people all over the world who share designs for using old plastic bottles to build hydroponic systems to grow food in their windows. And, you know, that's not going to solve all of our food problems. But it is starting to people coming up with something practical to do. And I think a lot of people, whilst there's a lot of cynicism in the world, are actually quite keen at finding things they can practically do, because people do worry about, you know, the world they will live in and their children will live in. And that's, for me, why it's so important that you don't just have works that say, here's all the problems, the end. And, you know, there are an awful lot of those around at the moment.
We'll carry on with the optimism about the future then. And let's look at some of the future technologies that you talk about. And the one I want to leap into straight away, because I think it's incredibly exciting, is 3D printing.
Ah, yeah.
So tell us how 3D printing will revolutionise manufacturing. Mm.
Right, well, 3D printing is basically printing out solid objects, literally as it sounds. There's a lot of different technologies that can be used, but they all basically print out one layer of an object, then another layer, and you build up the final object. So you can take an object, you either design the computer or you scan digitally, exchange data in a computer, and print it out. And already we can print out things in metal, in plastics, in glass, in chocolate even in these days. Now, the benefit of this, it means you can start to transport data around rather than transporting so many physical objects. So if you want to send a spare part to somebody, for their car or their washing machine or whatever, you can send the data. It can be printed out close to the point of consumption. So immediately you reduce the resources used in transportation. It also means that sticking, say, with spare parts, you don't have to produce lots of parts that may or may not be used. You only print out exactly what people want, so you reduce the amount of materials potentially involved. So 3D printing does have quite a big environmental impact potentially. I think the other one that's really critical is that today so many products we use, they are basically discarded once one piece goes wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, the number of times I've had a DVD recorder go wrong and you look inside and one piece of plastic has snapped off, but there's no way I could ever get a replacement for that piece of plastic and the whole device has to go. If we're in a world where you can go online, you can find that one part and print it out, or go to the high street and get a printout, then suddenly things like repair will become more possible. So 3D printing, it's an amazing technology in itself. It enables customization, but it also enables us to do things more effectively.
One of the things that I find most exciting about the concept of 3D printing is not just how it will revolutionise how we make things, but how it has a potential for changing the entire means of production, in that it's really exciting, the idea that it could democratise the making of technology. But then, of course, I'm reminded of the Ealing comedy, the Man in the White Suit, where there's sort of a backlash from producers who want to keep that sort of means of production with them. I mean, what do you think are the chances of us all having a sort of Star Trek type replicator in our own homes, and being able to remove a whole section of industry from between ourselves and the end product?
I think it will be limited to the entire extent of our own homes. We saw a few weeks ago at the Consumer Electronics Show, there was one of the first really good consumer 3D printers launched, which I think was $1,200. So that's still expensive, but it's coming down from the tens of thousands only a few years ago. So I think the opportunity for people to have in their homes a device that can print relatively small plastic objects, maybe up to 30 or 40 centimetres cubic, that is going to exist within a few years, as will bureaus. The opportunity to be able to get this done online, and again, these already exist. So you design something, you scan something, someone will send it back to you in the post. Or again, High Street will might have those possibilities. I've been talking to companies in America recently looking exactly at that. How do you roll out 3D printing in stores to enable people to get customized products, where they are, design it on your iPhone and print it out somewhere else. So I think 3D printing will become to some extent a consumer technology, but it'll probably more hit our lives because items will be able to be customized for us and printed for us. So much more manufacture at the point of consumption, or customizing certain parts of an object. I think people often go, well, 3D printing, they'll never print out an entire mobile phone, and they probably won't for 20 or 30 years, therefore it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And they miss the point, actually, you could customise a few parts of that, and suddenly a customised product exists because you've got a customised case with a standardised inside. And that comes back to your point about democratising what people can do. They can buy certain bits, they can customise other bits. There is already quite a community building up of websites where people have uploaded designs of things, and you can get that design, you can customise it, you can change it around. There was a whole site called Cubify, which was launched a couple of weeks ago, which is linked not just to a printer, but to online printing bureaus, to a community for sharing objects. So we are starting to see the opportunity, really, for objects to go the same way as information. We've got used to the fact we can move information around the world pretty much freely, and that's had big implications in areas like music and film production. We are hitting exactly the same issues, I think, will start to exist for physical objects, and it will raise enormous issues of intellectual property. You sell me an object today and I can basically use the object and that's it. If I can scan it and then actually print myself another one, you start to worry about, as the supplier of the object, well, is that person going to continue to buy it, or who owns the data? And it's very difficult with objects, because you could actually have print out of an object from two different looking sets of data that produce the same thing. Just create the thing in a different CAD package, it'll have a completely different data structure, but it's the same object. And so it's really difficult to police what you mean by an object digitally. At least for a piece of music, it obviously has to sound the same to be the same thing.
The other new technology that I'd like to look at is something else that, that has a whole, probably appropriate word to say, is a grey area around it. And this is nanotechnology. We've talked about it a couple of times on the show before. I'd like to sort of specifically talk now about, you talk in the book about ways in which actually it's already being used. I mean, this nanotechnology is at quite an advanced state of development. So what can we already do with it?
At the moment, we could use it to change material properties, particularly in things like coatings, producing certain types of plastics, that type of stuff. So it's starting to come into our lives. There's about 1,000 products worldwide that use nanotechnology to produce stain-resistant garments, produce windows.
The Man in the White Suit again.
The Man in the White that's right. Window glass that is self-cleaning, what will resist the dirt. we'd been producing better sunscreens by putting particles of titanium into lotions, that type of thing. So we've got quite good at producing new surface properties and new material properties using nanotechnology. And the other area, it's been massively successful, is producing silicon chips and memory for computers, that sort of area. So at the moment, we've got very good at in certain types of production processes and at changing certain types of materials, which gives us certain new properties. If you've got, say, a plasma TV screen, they are now thinner and lighter than they were 10 years ago because they have carbon nanotubes in the glass of the screen, which strengthens the glass, and that all means you can produce a cheaper set. So there's lots of areas where a technology doesn't sound that radical. It's had quite big implications already.
So where do you see this technology leading us in the future?
I think that there's various stages. At the moment, nanotechnology is all what they call top-down. In other words, you use chemical processes or photographic processes to change things at a nanoscale, at the atomic scale, but existing types of materials. And that will continue to progress. But there are also possibilities for what they call bottom-up nanotechnology, which is where you actually start to manipulate things on the nanoscale at a small scale itself. Now, science fiction has for years talked about nanobots and replicators, which can literally move atoms around, and you've got billions of these little things changing the world, if you like. Medicine is certainly starting to go in that direction. There are research teams in several universities in the United States who are producing tiny nanobots you can put inside the body to do fairly simple things at the moment. So they might, for example, detect a particular type of cancer gene, lock onto it, and release a particular cure. But effectively, that starts to get you to a point you could have nanobots in the body that will be ready to detect certain types of problems. There are teams working on nanobots for things like eye surgery, where they could inject a small robot into the eye, which will go and mend broken veins and that type of thing. So we're probably not more than 5 or 10 years out to having things injected into the body to do not incredibly complicated tasks, but things which even the simple things they can do will have big sort of health benefits.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Christopher Barnett about his book 25 Things You Need to Know About the Future. So, Chris, we've been talking about some future technologies. We began by talking about how we were rapidly reaching peak oil, so perhaps we should spend some time talking about how are we actually going to power all of these things and what our transportation is going to look like over the next few years. So you begin the next section, which is called Fueling the Third Millennium, by talking about electric vehicles. So to what extent do you think electric vehicles are going to become more usable?
I think electric vehicles are just starting to be a point of towards mass adoption, if you like, at the moment. We're seeing quite a lot of the major manufacturers have in the past few years been working on better and better electric cars, and they're now starting to advertise them in some cases, quite dramatically. So the technology, to a large extent, exists. It's not a terribly complex technology. It's electric motors and batteries, put in the car. If you can make the cars lighter and smaller, you can get a better range, but that's basically, what's going on at the moment. Clearly, people's worry about electric vehicles is how far they can go on a particular charge. People have what they call range anxiety. Now, to some extent, that can be eased by using technologies like nanotechnology we just talked about, to, say, improve battery electrodes to increase battery capacities. But I think there are also some companies taking a more radical approach. One that I think we'll start to catch on is what's called battery swap. So rather than having a system where you have to recharge the battery when you've gone a certain distance, you might actually call into a battery swap station, and in about a minute to 30 seconds, a robot would pull one battery out and stick another one in. So effectively, you can drive as far as you'd like in an electric car because you change the fuel over quickly, the same way we do in a traditional petrol vehicle. And there are already there's a big test going on at the moment in New York with taxis, where they've got these battery swap systems in place. That's working quite effectively. So electric vehicles is a mindset shift for people to a large extent. People have got used to cars working a particular way, although go back 120, 150 years, they didn't exist at all like that. So we will adapt, I think, slowly to that.
You spent some time talking about the future for renewable energies and wind and wave power. And
yeah.
I'd like to specifically look at solar power and the sun is clearly this, insanely huge source of constant energy, which is not going to be depleted just yet. So, and I was quite excited to read about the idea of being able to, harvest energy from the sun from space. So let's talk a little bit about that, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, there's clearly one of the problems you have with solar power is that you've got the fact it's obviously only available in the day as the Earth goes round, and the atmosphere can get in the way. So potentially, if you can put solar panels up in orbit beyond the atmosphere, and you can position them so they're constantly receiving energy from the sun, you could then beam that down to Earth using, say, microwaves. And there are companies just starting to ask if they can have some test things put up. There's clearly lots of issues that go on with this. We are assured that the beams they'd use to send power down to the Earth wouldn't fry anything in the way, but that clearly is an issue if you imagine that. So I think we will start to see, again, probably before the end of this decade, there will be at least test satellites up in space receiving solar energy and beaming it down to the Earth. And that's very much will link back to the growth of a private space business. I think the other thing one of the things that fascinated me on solar, the more I looked at it, was what's called concentrated solar power, which is basically the same idea as if you take a magnifying glass on a sunny afternoon and concentrate it on a piece of paper and you can burn a hole in the paper, except you do it with a massively bigger system than that. One of the systems uses what's called a Stirling engine, which is basically an external combustion engine. So we're used to in our cars having internal combustion engine that burn fuel in a cylinder to create motion. But in a Stirling engine, you heat it up and the gases inside a sealed engine move back and forth through some clever cylinders, which means in practical terms you can get a big solar dish, maybe 40 or 50 metres in diameter, direct its rays onto the Stirling engine, it'll turn and generate automatically. You've got electricity. And there are already concentrated solar power plants doing exactly that being built in Arizona and in Spain. To me, that's an incredible technology because it takes you all the way through from the sun, as you say, as a constant source of power, through to, in some ways, quite an old technology. Stirling engines have been invented over 100 years ago.
For the final section of the show, the last two sections of the book, you look at, on the one hand, the future of both computing and inorganic life, so basically robots and artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And the last section of the book, you look at enhancements to ourselves, to humanity, be that through medicine or cybernetics or even sort of extensions to life. And
yeah,
I'd like to, in the discussion, combine those two chapters because I think a lot of the interesting issues actually crop up with where we combine those technologies. Before we do, you mentioned earlier this concept of the singularity. Let's talk about that a little again, because again, I think that is central to then what will become in all of these technologies.
Yes, I mean, the singularity is a concept that we are approaching, if you like, an event horizon of technological progress that's so powerful we almost can't understand, comprehend what we're beyond it. Many people associate the singularity with creating beyond human intelligence. So we'll be able to deal with problems and create technologies we couldn't currently do. Beyond human intelligence might be artificial intelligence creating a computer. It might be augmenting the human brain with computer technologies, cybernetics. Or, and probably more likely, it's going to be linking lots of people together with technology so that actually, the internet itself becomes the intelligence that's greater than any individual. And to some extent, that's already starting to happen in that people can go online and crowdsource ideas, share information, come up with solutions that no individual would have come up with. I think it's one of these ideas when you first hear about this singularity, it sounds like utter science fiction, beyond human intelligence, smart machines taking over the world. It isn't. It's about people being able to leverage their minds collectively with a bit of computer power, in the mix.
I think as well, you talk about the singularity as this idea of technology sort of speeding up, or not exactly out of our control necessarily, but to the point where we can't sort of imagine what the next sort of advances are going to be.
Mm.
And I think a sort of interesting issue to raise here is about ethics as well, because we're used to a sort of a pace of medical change. So over the past 50 years we've come to accept safe and legal abortion as being a right, and then there's been a discussion about stem cell research. We've slowly come to accept the idea that there's cloning happening and things like that. And I think once things start to speed up, it's going to be interesting. Do you think that we'll be able to keep up with having...
I think that's a big challenge. And I think the reason it's a challenge is because a lot of the reason for exponential progress, if you like, is because so many technologies are now complementary. So a lot of the developments in computing help people develop nanotechnology. Same developments help people develop genetic engineering. If you look back to, say, something like the Human Genome Project, which was, a genetic engineering study to decode human DNA, but finished faster than they thought it would because developments in computing power came along that they didn't anticipate. And I think one of the frightening things at the moment is we tend to regulate industries. And I think it's really weird that, for example, if you want to experiment on embryos and do genetic engineering, then you know that's highly regulated. Mm-hmm. It's virtually impossible in most parts of the world. If you want to create yourself an artificial intelligence, then that's not regulated at all. If you want to go and put some bits of DNA together to create an entirely synthetic life form, that's also not terribly regulated. And there's clearly a massive inconsistency there in that technologies all heading towards the same end, producing new forms of life in different states, have got completely different levels of regulation.
You mentioned the idea. Everybody always thinks of the sort of Terminator scenario of the robots becoming intelligent to the point where they decide we're dispensable and they take over. For me, that you know, an issue would be much more mundane than that, which would be we would get to the point where we could create robots that could displace human workers, yep. Which perhaps in dangerous work environments might be desirable, but then at what point do the robots themselves become, at what point do we need to have robot rights? Is the debate that you then get into, I think.
Totally. I think, you know, Korea is the first country to start drafting a code of ethics for, you know, protecting robots. It's never used it yet, but it's thinking about it. Clearly, we are heading towards a period of time where we will have more smart robots in the world. Many people may seem to like Honda's Asimo robot, you know, which is, at the moment is developmental. But the thing that held robotics back hasn't been the practical robotics side, it's been the computing to control it. So to make a robot walk along, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, they tried to just work out the optimum routine and build it mechanically. We now know walking is basically the art of control falling over, and that basically you'd have to be able to sense the environment around you constantly, and we've now got computer power to do that. If you want to create robots effectively, you need very good engineering skills, produce lots of new parts. How can you do that? Oh, we've got 3D printers. You know, so I think within 10 years, there will be humanoid robots, not looking exactly like people, but capable of working in the human world, doing human tasks, as you imply. I think there'll also be terrific pressures to create them, because if we have a world with less oil, we won't be able to transport things around as much. And if you look at Europe and the United States, we've become dependent on cheap goods, which are made in other parts of the world, a lot in China and India, shipped back to us. We've relied on cheap labour, in other words. If we have to make more things at home, we'll want that cheap labour to be here, and robots offers a potential for that. So you can see how it'll start off. Companies go and we will build plants close to our point of distribution in the UK or wherever, man them with robots, and then suddenly they exist, and it's, did we mean to do that? You know, and I think people tend to think, well, we couldn't get loads of robots very quickly. But for me, you know, you look at something like the PC, where we went from no personal computers to about a billion in 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we are really on the point now of we could easily have 100 million, 200 million robots in 20 years, occupying the planet with us, if you like. As you say, what rights do they have, what rights don't they have, whose jobs do they take, do they have a right to think by themselves now and then?
And of course, parallel with this is the idea of cybernetic enhancements, enhancing human beings, be it through somehow manipulating our evolution or ageing, or technological advancements to sort of bionics. And will there become a point in the future where we're living on a planet where the, you know, cybernetic humans and robots side to side, and we have to change the definition of what human is?
I think that will happen. I think one of the image that probably people have in their heads when we talk about robot is something quite technological in terms of it's made out of plastic and metal and it looks shiny and it's got lots of LEDs on and that type of thing, isn't it? One of the developments that's going on today coming out of 3D printing is called bioprinting, which is where we don't print out with a printer plastic and metal, we print out living cells. And we are probably only 5 years away now from printing out organs like kidneys and using them in tests to put them inside people. So we'll be able to alter people, not by sticking in bits of metal and plastic, which the body rejects quite readily, but by producing organic new parts of the body, probably from a culture of someone's own self. And that inevitably will also span into robotics, in that a lot of the future robots will be organically printed. Almost that's inevitable. Many 3D printers will produce their outputs using bioplastics, not traditional oil-based plastics, because we won't have the oil-based plastics. So that whole spectrum of what is organic, what is inorganic, what is human, what is another type of machine is a very blurry thing. And I think, coming back to your earlier point, it's one of these things we haven't started to really latch onto. You know, we've had 20 years of massive change in computing, which no one really thought about too much, and there weren't big ethical implications. You know, no one really cares where you produce microchips and what you do with them. But the technology is now coming along. Changes in genetics, changes in medicine are, for some people, deeply objectionable on ethical grounds. And yet they are we're almost going to slide into this if we don't seriously think about regulation and you know what we need to do.
One final question then. Mm. We've talked about the challenges that face us because of peaks in natural resources and oil and climate change. You've talked about this concept of the singularity, a point at some indeterminate point in the future where sort of all these technologies will come together and race ahead. How optimistic are you of that actually happening, or is there a danger of we just not get in there because of the depletion of resources?
I think we have probably a window of opportunity left of probably about 20 years. For me, I've been looking recently at some of the very early works on this, something like The Limits to Growth, which was published back in 1972, where a very distinguished group at MIT looked at all the world's resources and said, we've got 20 or 30 years to sort things out, and we haven't. And we are certainly have a lot less opportunities now than we did back then to deal with having relatively few resources. But at the moment, most of the organisations in the world, the governments, big companies are still functioning. We do have resources left to make changes, but we are going to have to speed up and do it because clearly, as you've just implied, wait 20 years and the opportunity to use technology to actually feed the world, to maintain civilization, anything like what we know it, will have gone by. So we do need to start speeding this debate about not keeping alive the economy, this thing that we all, is an artificial creation, but keeping alive the biosphere, the whole planet that keeps us alive, and the basics we need to actually feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, allow us to communicate, etc.
That's fantastic and a perfect place for us to end. So I've been talking to Christopher Barnett about his book 25 Things You Need to Know About the Future. It's out now from Constable Books. Christopher, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.